You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
Belted to left field. Billy comes through tonight. Splash!
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. We're here with another, as we're recording this, another Baseball Monday. I, of course, am your host, Jeff Herr. With me, as always, is the indubitably prepared Michael Engel. Mike, how's it going?
I'm up to my elbows in papers and notes and ink and quill and everything. I have my abacus at the ready. My slide rule is in my pocket protector. I am ready for a show.
For those that don't know, Michael Engel actually writes all of his blog posts in feather, quill, and ink. It's very impressive if you just fancy. It's mesmerizing to watch. And then Kevin Scobie translates for him the typed page for all his blog posts. So a little something you didn't know about Michael Engel there. So we're just here to disseminate the information to you folks. The more you know. Star. But to get on to the Royals stuff here.
That's why everybody tunes in.
That is why everybody tunes in. I don't know if they necessarily care as much as you and I do about your writing habits, but
I'm
sure if they listen to this show, they probably read your stuff. And one thing that always interests me is people's process, right? So hey, if you need to have a quill pen and an inkwell and write in perfect Japanese calligraphy and have somebody translate that to you, then so be it, you know?
The results speak for themselves.
Indeed they do. Different strokes for different folks.
Literally.
There it is. Boom. Get it? Pen stroke. Yes.
Yeah. Ding.
Point for Michael Engel. All right. So we're actually doing a show right now, in case you were. Don't stay with us here.
There's like 15 minutes of nonsense we recorded before this that I'm tempted to just leave in at the end or something. But
you know, we might. I almost thought about saying just screw it, not even doing a lead in, and just being like, "All right, we're
just in this." Yeah, hit the ground running. It was a weird day. There's a lot of stuff happened today.
Yes, so we should probably actually get to it then and start talking about it.
Sure.
Before we actually talk about what happened today, and today, for those that might be listening after we record, which is going to be everyone, today is June 30th as we record this, and the Royals have not played yet tonight. So whatever happens tonight against the Minnesota Twins, we are unaware. But as of right now, what we are aware of is last week we were in the midst of the highest of the highs. A little bit, we had come off a couple losses, I think, at that point, but still, you know, breathing in the fumes of a 10-game winning streak, a first-place Royals charge, and exactly what we said couldn't happen or needed to not happen in order for the Royals to move on to the playoffs and take a hold of this division is exactly what happened. Because they're the Royals, because this is what we love to call the Royal Coaster, we are in the midst of not quite a losing streak, although it was for a bit there, but the Royals are 3-7 in their last 10. They were 3-6 on the 9-game homestand they had. Now, granted, they faced a lot of good pitchers, so you know it's tough when you're facing Zach Greinke and Clayton Kershaw on consecutive nights. Even though they won against Zach
Greinke, beat Greinke, yeah,
And they knocked him around for was it 4 runs, 5 runs?
Yeah, I mean they hit him pretty well.
So even still, you know it's tough when you're night in, night out. You're going up against some of the best pitchers on the planet. But regardless, you know, if you want to be that good team, you want to take that next step, you got to win those games. And the Royals didn't win all of them. They lost the majority of them. And now they're sitting at 42-39 again, as we record. So whatever happens tonight or in between now and when you listen, you know, obviously we're not aware of, but, they're 3.5 games behind the Tigers. That's kind of the negative side. But the plus side is even though they have kind of scuffled a little bit after the big streak, so have the teams behind them, and they've actually increased their lead on third place. So the Cleveland Indians are now, is it 3 or 3.5 games, Mike, behind? I think it's just 3.
Yeah. So, I mean, but they got some distance. There was a lot of grouping and stuff in the middle there. The Royals go on this 10-game streak and they get up there, and it's almost kind of like the weird timing of last year where they went on that big run and everybody else was going on the same run. But this time when they hit their skid, that's when Detroit decides they need to go 8-2 over a 10-game stretch. So, I mean, that right there is the big difference overall. I mean, you've got, you know, 4.5 game swing there. So that's pretty tough to kind of swallow after a couple of days in first. But, you know, the Royals, they're only a game and a half out of the second wild card, and we're at the halfway point of the season. So there's still some time, and there's some promise that we'll talk about a little later in the show. But, you know, I guess the Royals had to kind of come down after that 10-game streak, and they lost those, you know, the first 4 games after the 10-game streak and kind of split the rest of the way. So they kind of did okay in some spots. You still, you know, you don't want to go to a homestand after hitting first place and go 3-6. That's kind of like, you know, the big, you know, dropping a brick on your foot or something. I don't know what analogy I'm looking for there, so I'm going to just go with the brick on the foot. But that, you know, they're still in it. I mean, they're not out of it by any stretch, and there's still potential for them to bring in new players and see what happens as far as, you know, getting a little more in the offense, which was kind of the big thing. They only scored one run a couple games in a row. They got shut out in there, and that was a big part of what really led to the problem. They did win the series against the Angels, and they did so by getting some offense. Scored some runs, and Omar Infante had a grand slam, and Lorenzo Cain had some really, really good days. And so, you know, if they're scoring runs, it's like we said at some point last week, you know, if they're about average scoring runs, they're going to be in the mix, you know, all year. It's just they've got to be able to go out and score those runs, and that's tough when, you know, you don't have a lot of power and you don't have a lot on base.
What's so interesting to me about this Royals team is we went around at the beginning of the season and we all gave our predictions. You know, we had I think we had a show where did we have Leski on, and then we have like a roundtable thing. Maybe that was last
season. I don't remember. That was a long time. I mean,
yeah, maybe that was the
season or something. I don't remember last week that well.
Yeah, so. But anyway, we all made our predictions and they were all in that, you know, 82 to 87-ish game win range. And what's funny is the ultimate conclusion there is that we all kind of thought the Royals were the same. We thought they were a kind of middling team. And, you know, if they get some breaks, they're going to be a few games above 500. If they don't, they're going to be closer or maybe a game or two below. Who knows? But point being, what's fascinating is that that's exactly what the Royals are right now at 42-39 on pace for, what is it, 84, 85 games, 85 victories, or 84, because they're exactly at the midway point. So yep. On pace for 84 wins, which is right in the meat of what we all predicted. But just kind of like last year, they just haven't gotten there in the way you would suspect. You know, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I don't pay close enough attention to the rest of the teams in the league and, you know, the middling ones and how they get to where they are. But you see a team at 42-39, then you think, okay, well, you know, they win kind of like the first 2 months of the season, right? You kind of thought the Royals were just, they'd win 4 out of 7, they'd lose 3 out of 8, or they'd win 3 out of 8, you know, and so they'd just kind of flip them around and kind of just middled around for a while, and they went on these streaks. So it's just lately, and then ultimately what the whole season now, it's just so weird because they get there by being the best team in the league for 10 games and then one of the worst for the next group of 10 games. It's just so it's kind of fascinating, similar to how it was last year. You know, you're 4-19 one month, and you win 16 out of 20 the next month. It's just like, where does this come from, you know?
I don't know. I mean, there's enough time in the year that it can kind of, you can get those little runs, and, you know, really even bad teams can go on a run like that in a baseball season, and good teams can go on bad streaks as well, just because, you know, that's what it is. It's kind of a cycle, but it still seems like for the Royals, they're more extreme when they happen, like, you know, 10-game winning streak, or, you know, that period last year where, you know, they go 4-19 and they look terrible. And so I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's just a baseball thing that's kind of weird that happens, or if it's the Royals. I would say, though, that for a team like the Royals, who does, you know, the team does run into problems scoring runs, they're going to be prone to some of those periods where they're going to have a lot of problems getting wins when, you know, even if they get good pitching, you know, those 2-1 losses, those really sting. And those are things that other teams won't run into that often. And so I think the bad streaks might be lower for some other teams who are able to score more runs, or at least be closer to average. But the Royals also, they have the pitching and defense that's going to keep it from getting too bad. So if they do score 2 or 3 runs, they still have a shot. And so that's kind of been what's kept them in there. I mean, all of their starters have ERAs under 3.7. Jason Vargas has been really good, with the exception of last start and another, you know, that start against the White Sox. And Shields has been, you know, not quite as good, but he's still pretty darn good. Ventura and Duffy have been really good, and Jeremy Guthrie's been really surprising. So when you get those guys, you get a good back end of the bullpen together, and you get the best defense in the league, that's going to keep you in games even if your team's not hitting the ball very well. And they're not hitting the ball well, but they did in that streak, and they have here and there in the last month. And so I guess it adds up to, you know, a lot of little bad stuff and a lot of little good stuff. And yeah, you kind of settle in the middle there. It's a lot like last year where, you know, a lot of this is basically the same profile of the team, a lot of the same players. I actually thought coming into this year that the offense would be better than last year, because I thought getting Infante was going to be a good thing. I thought Nori Aoki was going to be a good addition. I figure that Moustakas would get better and not worse.
Silly Mike.
Yeah, I know, right? And, you know, those things didn't happen, but I also underestimated what Jason Vargas and Jeremy Guthrie would do and through the first half of the season. I mean, I understand how there would be skeptics of what they've done, but at the same time, they've done it. So I'm not going to really fret too much on it. And, you know, Duffy and Ventura look good, and Shields, I think, is kind of getting through as best he can. And the defense, you know, that doesn't slump that often. That's the most stable thing you've got. And you got the best outfield defense in the league. You've got, you know, a solid middle infield. You've got Sal Perez. So, I mean, there's a lot of good.
And that's kind of another fascinating thing, too, where back to the Royals are who we were, but not how we thought they would be, if that makes sense. Like, just like you said, we thought the offense was going to be better and the pitching was going to be worse, and so it was going to wash itself out. But that's not what happened. The pitching is just as good and didn't drop off, but the offense was just as bad and didn't, you know, come up. So, again, just another one of those kind of weird things about how did the Royals get here? Well, you know, it's just funny to me that we went into the season thinking one thing and it's gone another way, but they end up kind of back where we thought they were. So, you know, if they end up winning 85 games, we'll look back and say, you know, yeah, that was, you look at it from the outside and you say, okay, that's what everybody thought the Royals would be anyway. But then you kind of look at it and it's like, well, the record was the same, but it wasn't quite the Royals that everybody thought it was going to be.
Yeah. And, you know, they kind of traded, like, you know, last year they started off with Chris Getz and Jeff Francoeur, and they were big holes, and Mike Moustakas was bad, and Escobar wasn't hitting. And now Escobar is hitting, and Lorenzo Cain is hitting, and Perez and Gordon, they've been hitting. Butler's been hitting better, but now Hosmer's not hitting. You know, Aoki wasn't hitting. Moustakas is still that black hole. So it's like they traded the bad spots in the lineup. It's just different players and where they got some production. Like, you know, Eric Hosmer approached 200 hits last year, almost hit 300. You know, really good producer. This year he's not doing that. And, you know, they've kind of made that up by Lorenzo Cain having a good offensive year. And Alcides Escobar, who leads the team in hits, by the way, would not have expected that, especially since he started like 0 for 21. And so they've kind of gotten production from other guys. And it's mostly balanced out to where they're about the same offense. Nobody really stands out as like the power guy or the on base guy. So there's not really that one marquee player in the middle of the lineup who, you know, like Miguel Cabrera or Giancarlo Stanton or David Ortiz, that those are the guys who are going to be able to produce runs. They'll get on base. Even if they, you know, they don't hit out of the park or they don't rip a double, they'll still be able to get on base a good amount of time because they'll get walked. You know, so those guys don't really exist in the Royals lineup. And so that makes it difficult where maybe you do have some balance, but, you know, it's kind of like the high ceiling, high floor kind of thing. Okay, maybe this is a baseline, but they're not going to go much higher than where they are. And, you know, we talked about that a couple weeks ago, and we've talked about it. We've seen it in other articles where this is kind of who they are. And yeah. No one's really going to exceed, you know, what they've got in their lineup.
Yeah, and it's an unfortunate, to take a step back, it's an unfortunate reality of being a Royals fan, it seems, that no one really, I guess I shouldn't say that. I was going to say that no one really plays over their heads, but I shouldn't. Remembering Alcides Escobar's 2012 and actually what he's done this year, and maybe Lorenzo Cain, I mean, I guess it's not really fair to say that you don't really, but it seems like maybe it's just because I'm a dejected Royals fan, but it seems like it happens less for the Royals than it does for other teams, that you get that those guys just seeming, you know, having those career years and, you know, playing above their heads, even if it's just a little bit, you know, if you like.
Well, yeah. I mean, you look at the A's, and they're getting 30 home runs out of Brandon Moss each of the last couple of years. And exactly. Josh Donaldson is the leading vote getter in the All-Star game, and for good reason. And, you know, the team was just in Kansas City, the Angels. They've got, you know, C.J. Cron. You know, exactly. I'm not that familiar with that guy, but that guy's hitting 300. He's got like 8 home runs. The Royals don't have some guy who just randomly pops up to do that.
Yeah, I mean, and the Cardinals for a while, they got
just like half their roster every year. Or those guys,
you know, Skip Schumacher a few years ago, and your David Freezes of the world,
that Matt Carpenter and Matt Adams, and
people coming up out of nowhere and producing for a major league club. So, but since it may seem like the Royals don't do that, in order to try to alleviate some of that, the Royals will sometimes make some moves, and they did so today. How about that for a transition right there?
Oh, that's what we in the radio business call a segue, except we're not in the radio business. No, but so
it's the same principle.
Right.
That principle leads us to the moves that the Royals did today, which were they signed Raul Ibanez, who is currently old enough to be my grandfather, and not really folks, I'm not that
pretty young. Close
they signed Raul Ibanez to a major league contract. Excuse me, sorry about that. We'll edit that out later, probably not.
Probably not. Which, you're right.
I think Ibanez was still in the Seattle system, right?
He was with the Angels. He spent 2013 with Seattle.
That's right.
I mean, he's kind of bounced around. I mean, he started with Seattle, went to Kansas City, went back to Seattle, went to Philly, went to the Yankees, 1 year in Seattle, 57 games with the Angels, and they released him. And then he pops up. He pops up.
One of Moustakas with a 157 batting average, 206, 235 on base and slugging, and just all kinds of nastiness. But anyway, the Royals sign him to a major league contract, pop him on the 25-man roster, and now he is a 42-year-old fifth outfielder who, well, once Aoki comes back, he'll be a fifth outfielder, assuming that they don't just cut him when Aoki comes back, which is certainly very possible. But right now he's the fourth outfielder, soon to be fifth. And, I mean, I'm not exactly sure what to make of this move, Mike. To me, it seems like it's a shot in the dark. Maybe we'll get lucky and he'll hit 250, 10 home runs the rest of the year, and he'll be, you know, some left-handed power off the bench. I mean, you think of it kind of like, to give it a football analogy, if you have like a, if you have a couple pass rushers, like say Tom Bali for the Chiefs, you know, he's getting a little bit older, so the Chiefs draft a young pass rusher, and they've got three solid pass rushers now. We can kind of rotate that third guy in, and if he's older, it'll keep him fresh for longer, deeper into the season. So maybe that's what the Royals are thinking, like, well, we're not going to make him an everyday player. We're just going to have him come off the bench. Maybe he plays in 40% of the games the rest of the way, starts every once in a while, and maybe we can find the fountain of youth for him. And, you know, he spurs some runs for the Royals. I don't know. I mean, what do you make of something like this?
Well, I can see why they would take a shot on him. If you go all the way back, 2001, he hit 11 home runs, or 13 home runs, rather. And every season since, he's hit double digits. And for the most part, he's a 20 home run plus guy. He's hit 30 a couple of years. He hit 29 in 2013. So that's really what the Royals are kind of looking for, is a guy who can come out and, you know, give them some kind of power. And, you know, he only hit three home runs with the Angels, and that was in 190 plate appearances. You know, really seemed like a severe drop off. Each year since 2001, he's been a guy with an OPS plus above 100. So he's been above average, playing pretty much full time in most of these stops. And with the exception of 2011 with the Phillies, you know, that was the only year where he wasn't, you know, that was kind of where the drop off kind of started. But he still hit 20 home runs, still had 31 doubles, and still had a 91 OPS plus, which is not that bad. Especially, you know, if he could be that kind of player, you'll take that. You know, he's a guy, since he was released, the Royals are only going to pay him the minimum, or at least prorated minimum from here on out. So it's worth taking a shot. There's very little risk, I guess, in this. They're not blocking anybody in particular. They're not putting a lot of money out there. The cost was really just Justin Maxwell, who hasn't done anything all season anyway. Who they had to designate for assignment to make space. And if Ibanez does turn it around and hit something, well, then, you know, there you go. You get something out of him. If he doesn't, well, you've got the opportunity to just drop him and, you know, forget it and move on.
So, yeah, I mean, it's one of those very low-risk maneuvers, but...
It is still really weird.
Yeah, it's still strange. I mean, the guy's 42 years old, and it's, I mean... Actually, before we were talking about this before we went live, and or live before we started the actual show, and Mike actually used the Baseball Reference Play Index, which is a sponsor of ours, by the way. And don't forget, we're still having the contest. If you want to find an interesting Royal stat, and send it in to us. We'll talk about it on air. Michael set you up with a book, and you can or you don't have to use the Play Index, but if you do want to use the Play Index and help us out, since they're a sponsor, type in promo code Royals, get $6 off your subscription. Anyway, Mike used the Baseball Play Index to find all of the players who have played for the Royals over 40 years of age, and it was a pretty interesting list, wasn't it, Mike?
Yeah, it was actually a pretty short list, too. And sorry about that text message. May the odds be ever in your favor. Let me put that on silent. We can edit that out, but I know our producer won't do it because he's lazy. That would be me. But yeah, it's an interesting list of there's only six players now that have ended up suiting up, right? Counting Ibanez, and Ibanez will officially the third oldest player to suit up for the Royals. Gaylord Perry played 1 year with Kansas City. He was 44 years old. Obviously spitballer, so he got a lot of mileage out of the tricks of his trade. Bob Boone was 42 when he retired in 1990 as a Royal. Interesting thing with Boone, the year before in 89, when he was 41 years old, Bob Boone won the Gold Glove in 130-some games as a catcher. At 41 years old, he still hit .274, got on base 35% of the time. Heck of a productive year for a 41-year-old catcher. Hal McRae and George Brett were both 41 when they ended their careers with the Royals. And Gene Garber, who doesn't really go down much in Kansas City baseball lore, he was a 40-year-old in 1988. So those are the six players that had been 40 years old or older with the Royals. Not a very big list. So I don't know. I don't know if that portends what their production might end up being. I mean, Boone had that season, George Brett, when he was 40. He hit .266, only got on base 31% of the time, but he hit 19 homers and had 31 doubles. So a lot of times what you do see with older guys is they have some power because they've kind of been around and they know how to hit it out. So that's kind of what you might expect. The interesting thing with Ibanez, though, is that he made his major league debut in August of 1996. And a couple weeks ago, the Royals drafted a kid named Chase Vallett, who is playing for Burlington now. He was born about 3 weeks after Raul Ibanez had made his major league debut. So Raul Ibanez's major league career is older than Chase Vallett of the Burlington Royals. So that's some perspective on the Raul Ibanez signing. Pretty crazy.
Yeah, and with the Raul Ibanez signing, as Mike said, the only thing that cost him was Justin Maxwell. But so they DFA Maxwell, and then...
And for as bad as Ibanez's numbers look, they look better than Maxwell's.
Yes.
So...
Yeah.
So there.
So that's a positive. That's a positive.
Right.
But then... Maxwell wasn't alone because with him, Pedro Siriaco got sent down. And to take his place, the Royals brought up 2010 first-round draft pick, number 4 overall, Christian Colon, who was the very, very, very first guest on this show, even before I was hosting, even before I was part of the show, and let alone hosting. And that is why everything just goes full circle.
Right.
You don't believe it. The universe has an order. Here we are. Christian Colon in the big leagues. Mike, what are your thoughts?
Well, it's about time.
Yeah, seriously.
I remember when he was drafted, there was a lot in the scouting reports that, okay, this guy's going to be a quick riser. He's a mature guy. They started him off in Wilmington right away. He hit pretty well. And then he kind of just stalled out in the middle there. He didn't have a really good second year in the big leagues. 2012, he was kind of hit or miss in some spots. Actually had a pretty good year in 2012, but mostly it was in Double A. And I think that was the year where he got called up to Triple A, fouled the ball off the plate, and it broke a bone by his eye socket. And it pretty much knocked him out for the rest of the year. And then 2013, he spent all year in Omaha and had a respectable year. And this year he's been having a little better year, better average, better on base. And they've kind of toyed with him in all over the infield, second, short, and third. I guess he's probably going to fill that same kind of utility role. He's, very much a balanced guy. I mean, he's got He's good enough where he could probably spell somebody at shortstop, but he's not good enough to play there every day. You know, he's a decent defender, but he's not anybody who's going to be, you know, an easy defensive replacement very routinely. He can make contact, but he's not really like a big average guy. He's got some pop, but not a lot. You know, he's kind of like, you know, that jack of all trades, master of none type of guy. 25 years old. You know, he's not, at this point, he's not befitting the draft pick that was used on him. I think he can still be a regular major leaguer in the right context. I think he can definitely be a solid bench player, but it's still going to be one of those things where I don't know how much he's going to play because they've got Infante around. They've got Escobar, who could be an all-star this year. They've got Moustakas, who I guess they could put him, you know, Colon at third more frequently, especially if they're not sure on Danny Valencia. So that might be an option, but I don't know. But I mean, it seems like we've been waiting for him to get here a long time, and it's good to finally see him, one, be here and be ready, and two, just get the opportunity in the first place.
Yeah, and that was kind of always the line on him, was just that his ceiling was an everyday player. And his floor was a really good bench option backup. And
neither of those are bad. It's just tough when you take them with the fourth pick in the draft.
Yeah, and I can't remember who was picked after him. Was that the Chris Sale?
That was the Chris Sale year. Yasmani Grandal was another guy. Yeah. I mean, you can play that revisionist game, and I think Sale probably should have been the guy, but...
Well, there were lots of connections. I mean, I think it was kind of 50-50 that people thought the Royals were going to take either Sale or Colon. So, I mean, we're just pulling.
It's not like it was a reach at the time.
Yeah, it's not like we were saying, well, why'd the Royals pass on Mike Trout? Well, a lot of teams passed on Mike Trout. But
right.
the Royals were in the discussion for Chris Sale. So, ultimately, they thought he was a reliever and they wanted starting pitching or skill position player, even though they just drafted Aaron Crow the year, but maybe because they just drafted Aaron Crow the year before. But regardless, you know, yeah, like you said, you can always play that game and you can always go down that road. But if I remember correctly from that draft, there were three projected elite players, and then it was just kind of a grab bag after that. It was Tyon and Manny Machado and
it was Bryce Harper.
Bryce Harper. Okay, yeah. Bryce Harper.
Yeah.
Wait. Was that? So who I thought.
Yeah, pretty sure it was.
Cause what?
Maybe a Strasburg. Let me remind myself.
No, right?
What's that?
Bryce Harper went number one though, didn't he?
Oh yeah.
So I thought Jameson Taillon went number one too. So I must be confused.
It was Harper, Taillon, Machado.
Okay, maybe he went number two then. Never mind. Yeah.
Matt Harvey was in that draft. He would have been nice, but you know, again, we're not going to play that game. You know, but there's not a lot of other big leaguers out of that first round. Taiwan Walker, Michael, Nick Castellanos. I mean, there are some names, but. You know, at the time, I mean, all you can really do is say, okay, what was the decision at the time? And the decision at the time, maybe it was a little meh, but it wasn't like, okay, Christian Colon's just this enormous bust.
Yeah, and they had almost, I mean, you never want, it goes back to that kind of optimism is not a strategy type of thing, but I guess you could say they had the right idea at the time because their thought was, okay, we drafted Moose in 07. We drafted Hosmer in 08. You know, we've got this young core coming up, and they're going to be ready in about a year or so from now, but we still need more players. You know, at the time, I think they had they made the Greinke? Yeah, they had made the Greinke trade, right?
That was coming, yeah. And at that point, yeah, I mean, that's a good point to make. I mean, Colon was a college shortstop. Yeah,
it was right before the Greinke trade.
Yeah, it was
the Greinke trade. So they didn't have, point being,
they didn't have Escobar there.
And Colon,
they didn't, from 2010 on, they added so many shortstop prospects, guys like Humberto Arteaga and Raul Mondesi and Colon and Escobar and Jack Lopez and all these other guys. Orlando Calixte.
Kenny Dykroger, isn't he a shortstop too, or was
I think it was in college.
Yeah.
They're using him as a second baseman.
Right on. But
still, I mean, you know, they made a focused attempt to build up their middle infield talent.
And they
Cologne was like the first step, and they didn't know they were going to be making the Greinke trade for Escobar, you know, 6 months later.
And they wanted someone who could be ready when Hosmer moves to be ready, and that's when it was projected, like you said, he was supposed to be a fast riser. So, but regardless of the history of Christian Cologne, he's here now, and throw it out for me, Mike. Give me some expectations for Christian Cologne.
I think he can hit for average. You know, I don't know. It's tough because I don't know how many games he's going to play. I don't know if they're going to use him late inning, if they're going to just, you know, use him to spell Infante every now and then, or to, you know, platoon with Moose. It's tough. So I'm not sure, but I would say he could probably hit about, you know, think about like Orlando Hudson with less power, you know, kind of in that 280 range of his average, and maybe a little bit on base, and just kind of go from there. You know, just not a lot of great offensive skill. He'll be okay in pretty much whatever position you put him in, but he won't be outstanding. So you're just kind of, you know, seeing what you can get. If they used him regularly, I think that'd be interesting. You look at his minor leagues, he's definitely shown that he can make contact pretty well. He's only struck out 194 times in, you know, over 2,100 plate appearances. So that's pretty solid, and he can walk a little bit. You know, walks, you know, 165 times in that same amount of time. So he does okay in those areas. So he's going to have pretty good bat control. But I wouldn't sit there and say that he's going to hit 300 or anything. I mean, I think if he can hit 270 and play good defense at three positions, he'll have a lot of value. But, you know, he could probably also go down and hit 240, 250 and only really play second and third, and then it's not as much value. So, you know, it's tough. But I'm glad he's up. I'm glad to see him up here. I'm kind of curious why, when Infante's been hurt a couple of times, he wasn't called up earlier. You know, when they kind of tried to make do with Siriaco, who just, you know, had some bad at-bats and some bad plays in the field and really didn't look all that good, you know, never really seemed like a guy who was going to stick. So Cologne, at least, I think, is probably going to be a little more poised, I suppose. I don't know. I'm interested to see, because I'm glad to see him up here, and it's nice to see that pick finally make it, because it seemed like he was just going to be stuck in Omaha forever. But now he's up. He gets an opportunity.
Yeah, and hopefully he'll make the most of it. So this is kind of what the Royals more or less have done to try and fortify their roster here on this last little mini stretch before they hit the All-Star break. And they've got some, again, it seems like we're probably going to say this. I think last time we said it, I think we said it wasn't going to be the last time we're going to say it, but Royals are kind of at another one of those precipices there for the season. You've got a 9-game stretch here. You got three against Minnesota, three against the Tampa Bay, and then three against Boston. Is that right?
I am pulling up the schedule to remind myself. They do Minnesota, Cleveland, Tampa, Detroit.
Minnesota, Cleveland, Tampa. So those nine
games. Then the All-Star break, then it's Boston.
Then in Boston, okay.
Yeah.
So you've got 9 games where the Twins are not that great. Cleveland is below 500 and a team that the Royals can and should beat. And then you've got Tampa Bay, who's struggling pretty bad this year.
Yeah.
The Royals have already beaten them this year. So the question is, you know, or I guess the goal for the Royals has to be win 6 of these next 9 games. Wherever that those 6 wins come from, you win 6 and you hope to maybe gain a game, maybe a game and a half on the Tigers, because then you've got a 4-game series right before the All-Star break where you're coming in and you've got maybe a 2-game deficit to the Tigers. If you win 3 out of 4 like they did last time, then boom, you're back in first place
right at the All-Star break.
Heading in, you've got a huge, huge vote of confidence. Everyone has a few months to just, or a few months, a few days to kind of take off, clear their heads, enjoy being in first place. It would last longer than it did last time, and then come back ready to get down to business and hopefully go on another tear like they did after the All-Star break last year. Because if you win 16 out of 20 straight out of the gate this year and you're in first by a game or a half game,
well, then it's fun.
Yeah, a lot of fun. And then all of a sudden you're looking at a month from now, maybe
you're at the trade deadline.
You're at the trade deadline. Oof. And, you know, who knows? Maybe then the Royals, maybe if they have enough room ahead, knowing the Royals, they'll stick and stay for sure. But if they would be bold and maybe trade a Wade Davis or Greg Holland and get another bat to fortify something and try and make it down the stretch, you know, I mean, they wouldn't be the first team to try and move like that. And, you know, who knows? But, you know, first they got to get through these next 13 games. The next nine are very winnable. And if they win six out of nine, I mean, I think that puts them in good position to make some noise.
Yep. I hope they do it.
Right. As do I. I think, and you know, it's what's probably going to happen is they'll win those six out of nine. They'll take three out of four from the Tigers. They'll be up a half game going into the break. And then, you know, next thing you know, they'll lose five out of seven coming out. They'll be two games back again, and then there'll be another stretch where we say, this is the most
important. Yep, yep.
I mean, if I've seen it once, I've seen it 100 times. That's how this Royals season's going to go.
And the cycle begins anew.
Yes. So with that, I think we're going to take our first break, and then when we come back, we're gonna talk about some things. We've kind of talked about the difference between the Royals hitting before and after Dale Swaim, but we're going to take a little bit of a different approach and dig even a little deeper than we have before into some different areas. So stick with us, and we'll hit you with that information on the other side.
Come to Spit Cup this week. We'll let the person who has the highest bar tab ride the bull. We don't have any TVs in our bar, but we make our own entertainment. Mondays, it's free cover charge to anybody with a gun rack in their pickup truck. Tuesdays, we've got $8 beer night. All domestic beers are on special for only $8. It's Spit Cup. Wednesdays is longest tobacco spit. Thursdays is foot fungus night. Friday night is jamboree night. Bring your crap kick in your 10-gallon hats. And this weekend, you get our world-famous Spit Cup girls. You get to pick which one has the most teeth. It's Spit Cup. Talking to the wall.
Or you could go to Kelly's Westport Inn. The highest quality drinks with the lowest prices. You know what we do. Drinks, friends, plenty of TV showing sports. They've got all the basketball and all the baseball on. Live music on the weekends, the best pizza in Kansas City, and fun. Kelly's has the best rooftop patio in town and is voted one of the best places in Kansas City to check out the view, if you know what I mean, and maybe make a new friend. Make the best choice for your evening entertainment, Kelly's Westport Inn. Kelly's is at 500 Westport Road in Kansas City, Missouri. Kelly's Westport Inn.
And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. I am your host, Jeff Herr. With me, as always, Michael Engel. If you were with us for the first segment, which I hope that you were, we were talked about the Royals currently and some moves they made today, today being the day that we recorded this show, which is June 30th. But now, we've talked before about the difference in hitting between the Royals pre and post Dale Swaim. And last time we talked about it, it was a little bit more prevalent because they were hitting the ball over the yard. Now they've cooled off a little bit in the last week and a half or so. And so it's really a little bit more relevant of, you know, was it just a natural surge for the normal progressions that you have over a season? Was it a hitting change, the hitting coach change, and they just had a surge because of the new difference? Or was it nothing at all and it was just, you know, these are how things go? So we decided to dive into a little bit differently, brought brought up by this article that was written by Robert Arthur on Baseball Prospectus called Moonshot. And it talks about the Royals pitch selection before and after Dale Swaim. And he took a quote. I'm going to just go ahead and read it. And I think he makes a good point just from a philosophical standpoint about Swaim's quote when he took over. And I usually nail the Royals a lot for doing the opposite of this, so I want to give them credit, particularly Swaim credit, for saying this. First, I want to bring up a quote that he talks about from Mark McGwire, who's the LA Dodgers hitting coach, and what he said. So this is Mark McGwire's random quote. It says, "I love seeing frustration in the opposing pitcher, and I saw that with Storen," McGwire said. "I love seeing our hitters work the count. When you work the count and see as many pitches as you can each at bat, it sets the tone for the rest of the lineup, and it sets the tone for the game." And his point, which I completely agree with, is that was a bunch of platitude-filled nonsense that really is just what you tell reporters and doesn't really mean much. You know, like, it's one of those things that the Royals typically say. You know, work the count, see as many pitches as you can, set the tone, all that kind of stuff. Those are just buzzwords that, unless you truly know what they mean and what you're trying to do, they don't mean anything. And most people don't. They just throw them out because it sounds nice and it's easy to tell reporters. Well, and that's what the Royals do all too often. However, the Royals, Dale Swaim, when he took over, one of the things he said is here, and I quote from the article, "The bottom line is we struggle with elevation and we swung at pitches down in the zone probably way too much," he said. From thigh high to the top of the strike zone, we're not doing enough damage. So here you have what he pointed out, that he being the author, and I completely agree with. And like I said, I want to give the Royals credit, and particularly Swaim, that he talks about a legitimate reason for why he thinks the Royals are struggling and what they're going to do to remedy it. They swing at pitches down in the zone way too much, and they need to do more from thigh high to the top of the strike zone. And, you know, that was one of the things that just the Royals, I don't know if they explicitly said it, at least not in as plain of terms, but, you know, from what we knew of the organization and kind of what they preach and obviously the results on the field, you know, we know that the Royals hitters and hitting philosophy keyed on those pitches low in the zone and, you know, kind of passed on the ones that were a little bit higher, even though sometimes you think those might be the ones that those are the home run type balls. You know, the Royals philosophy centered on keying on those ones down lower in the zone. So now Swaim was saying, well, we're going to kind of change that because it's not working for us. So Mike and I kind of took this, and there were some stats presented in the article, but first we kind of got some more general topics before we dive into the real nitty gritty here. So Mike, tell them what we found here.
Well, the Swaim was put into that hitting instructor's role on May 29th, so it makes it real nice for analysis to kind of give a clean split between a couple of months. So if you look at April and March, you know, the season start, March 31st, you know, the Royals hit 11 home runs that month. They had 13 home runs in May and really didn't do a lot. They had, you know, 682 OPS in April and March, 639 in May. In June, and this is the first full month of Dale Swaim coming into this game at least, 22 home runs. So they nearly doubled their full home run output. They had just as many doubles, just as many triples. They had, they had the same number of hits, but it was in fewer plate appearances and at bats. So they had a higher average, better on base percentage, and they were more productive hits because they went for more extra bases. I mean, they had 31 more bases than in May. They scored, you know, 122 runs coming into this game versus 108 in May, 105 in April and March. And really, you look at their slugging jumped from 339 in May when it was pretty low to 417 in June. So you're getting a lot more production, a lot more power from Not just particular guys. I mean, Gordon and Moustakas when he came back, and Perez have kind of been the power guys. But Hosmer hit a few homers. Butler hit a couple. He's hit a lot more doubles lately. Escobar's hit a bunch of doubles. And so you get a lot of these players who are hitting for a lot more power. And it would seem that, okay, maybe the approach as far as getting on base, I mean, their walks are lower than they were in either of the previous 2 months. But they're also hitting the ball with more authority and with more power, it seems like, at least by these month-by-month results. And the interesting thing about the article on Baseball Prospectus is that they looked at the height of the pitch player by player and then team by team. And generally, yeah, at the point when the article was posted, they did swing at pitches higher in the zone, more frequently. And so there is, maybe it's too small a sample size. Maybe it is a causation correlation thing. Maybe it's coincidence. But, you know, given that there is a concerted effort and identification of what a problem might be and an effort to correct that problem and that results came from it, I'm willing to say that there was something to this. And, you know, that's an interesting thing going forward, because if they continue to stay with these kinds of adjustments, you know, what does that mean for the offense going forward as, you know, Butler and Gordon and Kane and Perez continue to produce? You know, is that something where Dale Swaim really is, you know, coming up with something? So month by month, it's definitely there as far as the results. Now, the one thing I would warn is we also looked at the batted ball by month, and it's basically about the same. April, it was a bad line drive month for the Royals, but fly ball, ground ball, they're all basically the same between the three. They're very close, at least. So there's not a lot underlying there to support a big change, except for perhaps, you know, their fly balls are leaving the yard more often. Line drives, perhaps, you know, a line drive is categorized only as a line drive, not necessarily how hard it's hit. And that's based on the information from FanGraphs. So it's kind of tough to kind of pull those things out. So on the surface, it looks like the results have been better and maybe slightly better on the batted ball. So I think they're onto something with this whole thing. And it's pretty interesting to continue to watch it and see, because I've been frustrated just like anybody else where you see a ball right down the middle, belt high, and they let it go for some reason. You know, that seems like a pitch that everybody else will crush that the Royals don't. And if Swaim's identified that, then that bodes well, I think.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm inclined to believe that there's something there. And with the Royals, it's always hard to tell, because you might think they get something going and they finally got it figured out and then they just implode. But all the right. same. And I think what you said with the batted ball and that kind of stuff, how that is not a huge change, I almost think that's important and almost a better sign that things are, that he's really onto something, Swaim. I mean, because if it's not something that's BABIP fueled to where it's just, well, you know, they happen to be hitting it where they ain't for this period of time. You know, if all that is being the same, the only thing that's going up is their OPS and their home runs, it's like, well, yeah, then all they're really doing is, like you said, turning some fly balls into home runs. And that would lead me to believe that he's onto something. And, I mean, how many games would the Royals have won earlier in the year, you know, if they had, you know, a double was a home run or a single, you know, was a double, or, you know, a ball that was a ball that was a strikeout, you know, that they just watched go by, you know, could have been a pitch that now Swaim is like, hey, swing away on that bad boy. And they could have put that in the seats or could have put it into the gap. And, you know, maybe they win an extra game or two, and you're looking at a lot closer race right now than even as close as it is. So, I mean, I don't think it's nothing. It's too early to tell if it's truly going to take hold, like you said, but I think it's incredibly relevant and something definitely to keep an eye on, that we'll definitely keep our eye on. Cause, I thought it was just really, really interesting that, to kind of see it put like that And I definitely think it's something that the Royals should keep an eye on themselves and maybe kind of incorporate this in their philosophy all through the ranks to kind of free up their hitters a little bit more. I think in the past, just from things that we know and how they see with their developmental process, they might be kind of too sheltered with their hitters sometimes. Maybe they kind of restrict them a little too much. So to allow a little bit more freedom, I don't think would be a bad thing.
Yeah, and I think it's nice to see that they've taken that abstract idea of, okay, let's work the count, and applied an actual directive to it.
Yeah.
To where it's not just, oh, yeah, we want to work the count. It's like, no, we specifically want to do it this way because it's something that we've observed that we have not done. I mean, it's almost like science. You know, Dale Swaim's a scientist. Go figure. So that's encouraging to see that be something that gets applied at the big league level in the middle of the biggest year they could have. But I would also caution that yes, they seem to be doing better in June. Maybe it's because of Swaim, but at the same time, when they brought in George Brett and Pedro Grifol last year, the team turned around as well and started hitting better, and then turned right back around the first 2 months this year, you know, with Grifol there, you know, at the top again. They struggled. So, I mean, which is the real one? The 4 months where Grifol was really good and looked like he had things figured out, or the 2 months since? So it's one of those things where the cautionary tale is how much credit goes to the coaches, or blame, for that matter, versus going to the players. I mean, obviously, if the players are working on something, they've got to buy into it, and some of that is going to be the coaching. But you've also got to be that hitter who does it. You know, you've still got to hit it. They still have to be up there and pick the right pitch. And even if you're not instructed on it, you know, you shouldn't. If there's a big, juicy fastball coming down the middle of the plate, you shouldn't need to be reminded to crush that ball if you're in the big leagues. So there's something to be said to put it on the players, too. And maybe the change going to Swaim was a wake-up call in that regard. And then when you apply those different, you know, development and directions and lessons and practice and attention to that pitch that's, you know, up over the middle, you know, maybe that adds up to something. So, you know, but I think the power numbers are definitely an encouraging thing. And I would put that definitely on Swaim. I think that it's not just because it got warmer. You know, they do look like they're able to hit that ball out of the park a lot more. And I think that's something to credit him on.
And you mentioned cautionary tale. I think the important thing to remember here is the cautionary tale is always Royals.
Right, right.
Because, and as you said last year, they kind of flipped things around a little bit and did better. And they came back and it was same old story at the first couple months of this year. Yeah. And it makes you wonder if it wasn't the Royals last year getting into a spot of desperation, saying, hey, do whatever you need to do. We need to save this season. We need to make a run at this thing. And then that happens, and they say, okay, everything's good now. Let's go back to the way it was. And, you know, just knowing what we know of the Royals, that would not surprise me in the slightest if they changed something and it worked, and they said, okay, well, it got us through this point. Now let's move back to the way it was. So that's the thing that you got to guard against. You know, if it works for a little while, then you got to hope that the Royals don't say, okay, that was great, but now let's go back to the way it was, because now we've got it figured out and we can still keep our old philosophy and it'll work just as well. It'll just be better, because that's what they kind of thought this year and it didn't work out. So, you know, at some point it's got to be that wake-up call to actually make that change permanent and kind of understand why you needed to make the change. This 2 years in a row now, 3 years in a row, you know, six hitting coaches in 3 years?
It's a lot of turnover. I mean, it's crazy. And, in some regards, I don't know how much it really matters. You know, I think they can affect a lot of change individually. Like, Kevin Seitzer overall, maybe he was the best of the bunch. But moreover, what he did, the biggest thing that he did was he got Alex Gordon back in line. And that's just like an individual thing. That's, you know, getting him right, getting his approach right, getting the reps right. And when that works out, you know, you end up with a guy who's an all-star, you know, one of the most productive players of the last 3 years. So that's one element where a coach can help out. With someone like Moustakas, who's said before he doesn't want to look at video and all that, well, what I don't know what you can do there as a coach. You know, if the guy doesn't want to be coached, you can't really do much with him. And if he feels like what he's done is going to be right, there's not much you can do to help him. You got to get to that point where they are asking for the help, or you basically, I don't know, force them into taking the help. And then how effective is that? So I don't know, but it's still not a good sign to have that many hitting coaches, no matter what the results are, just because, I mean, it makes it really easy to make you a punchline. And when the Royals haven't gotten that much better at hitting and still have to keep making these changes, well, it just starts to look ridiculous.
All right. So I think with that, I think we'll wrap up the show. Mike, do you have anything else you wanted to go over here?
Well, we should mention that Donnie Joseph was also traded. He was designated for assignment, and, you know, rough, you know, his one appearance this year, he got rocked against Detroit, and ended up the Royals still won the game, but he got crushed quite a bit.
Gave up a grand slam, didn't he?
Gave up a grand slam. I think he only got two outs. You know, in the minors, he hadn't been able to find the strike zone very well. And, you know, he's also kind of getting up there in age. So, you know, he was traded to Miami for cash considerations.
There was that one magical spring training that we'll never forget in 2013 where he was striking.
He struck everybody out. Everybody. Right. People who weren't even in Arizona, he struck them out.
Whiffing at air.
Didn't matter, yeah. Yeah, which is, it's kind of weird because he did it a little bit this spring too. And he looked really promising when the Royals got him after that the Broxton trade, but you know, it just never really turned on for him. And so the Marlins have some time to kind of just see what works on him. You know, if he gets any kind of control, he's got a good enough fastball and he's got a really good slider, but you know, it doesn't do much good if you're walking seven batters per nine innings, you know. Absolutely. So that's kind of been the thing with him. You know, otherwise, I don't have a lot. I mean, there's, by now, people have probably seen the Deadspin thing about Bruce Chen and Yordano Ventura in Minnesota. Frankly, we can't say much better than what we're going to put in the outtakes. So we're just going to just hang out past the end of the show, and you'll get to enjoy some outtakes. But before we go, just want to remind you to, you know, check out the Baseball Reference Play Index. If you want to sign up, you can sign up at baseball-reference.com/play-index. And when you sign up, you can get a full year of baseball stats. You can filter those by whatever criteria you want. You can find, you know,
anything you could imagine.
Literally. I was curious today about what James Shields has done as far as consecutive starts of five innings or more. And he had a stretch of his first 29 starts as a Royal. He threw five innings or more, had one bad start, but since he's had 21 starts that have been at least five innings. I also was curious about Yordano Ventura, and it turns out he is ranked fourth among Royals rookie starting pitchers in ERA plus, behind Jose Rosado and his poor shoulder, Kevin Apier and Paul Splitorff. So just a couple little nuggets that I found. But, I mean, the play index gives you a chance to search for, you know, you can find different seasons. You can find specific games. You can find events, like how many. You can find every instance where Billy Butler's hit a triple. I think his last one was in Baltimore in 2012. You can find player splits, which is interesting. And you can find team splits that way, too. That's how we dug up the information about Kauffman Stadium and home runs, was by going to the split finder. You can look at streaks. You can even look at batter versus pitcher matchups, and you can help support this podcast and the Royals Podcast Network by signing up at Baseball Reference by using the promo code Royals. Saves you $6 off the yearly price. You pay one $30 charge up front, and you're getting this number, you know, all these stats sorted however you like them, for about 8 cents a day. So, I mean, that's nothing. So, Check them out. And again, want to remind you about the little contest we're doing. Just send, you know, just about any Royals statistical trivia you can come up with to KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com. And we will kind of go through what we get. And I'm going to get a copy of The Art of Scouting, which we talked about last week, which is a book written by Art Stewart with Sam Mellinger. I'll get a copy of that. I have some copies of Safe at Home by Willie Mays Akins. And I know where to find an autographed copy of Frank White's book, too. So maybe I'll throw that in there and give you guys a choice by whoever we deem as the best little statistical nugget. So send those on in, and we will take a look at those. And again, Royals is a promo code for Baseball Reference and the Play Index. Help us out. You know, we do this for nothing. We're basically paying the bills and paying poor Clint Scholes back because he's in the red already for helping us with this network. So we want to get some cash back to him too, so that, you know, we're just looking to break even and keep giving you guys something interesting to listen to on your work drive or your lunch break or whatever it is however you indulge in our discussions.
Yes. And along those same lines, a word of caution. It is possible to lose hours that you don't even know where they went messing with this play index. So that's the only thing.
It's true.
It's a lot of fun, and you start going and you're like, I wonder about this. I don't know if you're anything like me, which I'm assuming if you're listening to this, there's at least some little bit of you that's right. A little baseball nerdy. Then it didn't even have to be sabermetric stuff. Just, you know, I wonder how many, you know, one hitters Greg Maddux threw. You know, it's like, boom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just set
how,
it up.
How many Maddux games did Greg Maddux throw? Maddux is the, I think it's complete game shutout, no walks under 100 pitches.
Yep.
Is that the criteria? I mean, how about that? If someone dig that up for us, email it to KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com. Boom, you're in the contest.
There it is. So with that, I think we'll leave you. Royals, again, as we're recording this on June 30, Royals begin a series with the Twins and a 9-game stretch. We'll be kind of, when we record next, we'll be right in the middle of that, maybe. I don't know. The holidays might kind of muck that up for a little bit. So we'll see. Hopefully we can maintain our schedule. But if not, we'll still be back next week. It might just be a couple of days delayed. So thanks for tuning in. And for Michael Engel, I'm Jeff Herr. And as always, go Royals.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.
Who are they? I'm curious.
Gaylord Perry, his last year. Bob Boone, okay. His last 2 years. Ibanez now. Hal McRae and George Brett, both 41. And then Gene Garber in 1988 was 40 years old. So, yeah.
Interesting. Bruce Chinn might join that list the way the Royals like keeping him around.
Yeah, probably will.
Hey, especially if he's mentoring Jordana Ventura on how to make it rain at the club, then you got to keep him around. Am I right? Or am I right?
Typical Royals won't even go to the club and spend the money. Small market problems.
Must be a David Glass strip
club. Granted, it's a strip club in Minnesota, so I mean,
probably not looking at that. I don't want to say, but I'm going to say that the talent is probably.
It's good to get the outtakes out in the first part.
Let's put it this way. The talent at a Minnesota strip club, I would expect to be commensurate with the talent on the current Minnesota Twins roster. That paints a picture for you.
All the strip clubs probably play Prince in Minnesota.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
Yeah. Every song is Prince.
Every song is Prince.
Every.
Like it's 1999 in Minnesota.